and I'm with the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs in Washington, D.C. And today our workshop we're going to talk about women and children in poverty and discussing the issues of unemployment. What I'd like to do is to share some things with you, and then at the end of this have opportunity for discussion about it, because I didn't come here with all the answers, but I have some information for you, and then we can talk about that. And I'd like to say that anything that I do with you here for the next several days will be from my perspective as an advocate in Washington. And I work for a religious institution, the Lutheran Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. And so the work that I do in Washington is through the lens of the gospel, with that kind of sensitivity. And I'd like to talk about for just a second the distinction between advocacy and lobbying, because I think that it's really important to say right up front that as an advocate, I work on behalf of other people, people who are poor, powerless, and disenfranchised, and that you as advocates will be doing much of the same thing. Rarely does an advocate, well, never does an advocate really speak to issues, public policy issues, on behalf of themselves. However, a lobbyist generally lobbies on behalf of their own self-interest or their own institution that they're representing or whatever. And I think that that's the primary distinction of the work and the interest that we are all about as advocates. And because of that, when I am working in Washington, I never see myself working apart from people in my church. And so it's really important to develop a network of people and to try to help people develop a working relationship together, so that as I go to Washington, you know, there's no money behind the work that I do. But there are people, there are votes, and that's where the power to speak comes, is based on the gospel and the people who are with me, and the people who we work on behalf of. Many times what we try to do is to bring people with us to speak who themselves are affected by the issues of public policy that we're trying to address. Okay? Are there any questions about that before I proceed?
For instance, who do you contact in the government on our behalf?
Primarily, we work with members, congressional members, senators, and representatives. In Washington, it would primarily be the staffers, because so often, most of these offices have many staff persons working there, and they're working primarily on particular issues, on primary issues. And so they are the ones most often that draft the legislation, that inform the congressperson, and so forth. And so it is a much better working relationship if we are working directly with that staff person than with the representative themselves. However, as a constituent, you have a great amount of influence over that member's decision, that their vote, by speaking to that person about the issue of your concern, much more than I do as a staff person in Washington. So that's the reason why many times we attempt to bring people with us into those offices who are constituents or who themselves are persons whose behalf we are speaking. Okay? We can talk about that more in greater detail. Okay. Because I work for a religious denomination, most often the faith groups develop what are called social statements. Are all of us, most of us are Lutherans in this room, right? But not all. Okay. We develop social statements or social policy statements that relate to our issues of concern. This morning I'd like to share with you social statements that were developed by two of the predecessor church bodies, Lutheran Church in America and the American Lutheran Church. I think I said I'd read them to you. I'd like to read from them. There are a couple of issues that are important relating to unemployment issues that have been, where the social statements provide the framework by which we do our work. And so the one from the Lutheran Church in America, entitled Economic Justice, talks about some of these issues, and we use this as the basis of interpreting our work. So I'd like to share this with you. Economic justice is that aspect of social justice involving the material dimension of social relationships and the social activities of production, distribution, and consumption of goods and services. Economic justice denotes the fair apportioning of resources and products, of opportunities and responsibilities, of burdens and benefits among the members of a community. It includes the provision for basic human need, fair compensation for work done, and the opportunity for the full utilization of personal gifts in productive living. Economic justice includes the elements of equity, accessibility, accountability, and efficiency. It further goes on to say that accessibility includes both the formal entitlements to political participation and legal redress, and such substantive entitlements, such as nutrition, shelter, health care, basic education, minimum income and or employment, as are needed for entrance into the social and economic community. Exclusion of persons from the community of work is a denial of the opportunity of realizing the divine intention for co-humanity. And then in a statement developed by the American Lutheran Church, a paragraph reads, "Nevertheless, churches, their members, and their leaders need also to exercise Christian social responsibility. They have the duty to protest against and to act responsibly, beginning in their own communities to correct those cruelties and injustices which deny basic human freedoms. Christians, both personally and corporately, have the duty to press for and to support measures which ensure that all persons, regardless of color, economic position, national origin, or ethnic grouping, have fair and equal access to education, housing, employment, voting, and public accommodation." So those paragraphs from those statements have been very helpful to the work as we look at addressing the issues of unemployment, the issues of civil rights in employment, the issues of discrimination, in other words, that people experience as they seek employment. And then, I didn't read to you, but in both of these statements, there are sections that are interpretations of the Bible that really are the lens through which we view the work that we are doing. Yesterday, I said to people who were here that the work of advocacy needs to be put in a context that is nonpartisan. Even though we are operating in the public arena or a political environment, we need to always understand that that work takes place from a nonpartisan perspective. And so, as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter to me whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. The primary issue of my concern is, and I hope yours, are the issues that affect people who are poor, powerless, and disenfranchised. And that should be what guides our response relating to the issues. However, the work that we do will be in this political environment. And so as we develop strategies to address the issues, we will be aware who's voting which way, which party they relate to, and all of that. But that isn't the judgment that is used. That doesn't make the difference for us as we proceed to do the work of advocacy. Okay? Well, I'm curious to know whether or not anyone here or anyone close to you in your family has experienced unemployment over a period of at least a month. Yes, okay. And I'd like to know that because I tend to believe that advocacy related to an issue happens when we have facts, when we can feel what it feels like to be in the position, in this case, of unemployment, or when we have come in contact closely with someone who has experienced unemployment in their lives. From that not always, but from that perspective, it gives us a different kind of lens from which to respond. You know, it is, we look at the technical, we can look at the figures, which I'm about to give you, but we also look at it from a feeling level. And so what I'd like for you to do for a moment is to just take a moment to talk about how it felt to be unemployed, how it felt to experience the relationship with someone who was unemployed.
Oh, somebody's been here before me.
And before you tell me, I would say to you that for about three and a half years, I worked in Arizona through Lutheran Social Ministry of Arizona. I was the director of an employment counseling program called JobMart. And I encountered unemployment every day. People who were going through a crisis, really, in their lives. And what that felt like was something that really got my attention and concern. So how did it feel for any of you, or who do you know who's been unemployed? How did it feel? Yes?
I worked on the same job for 28 years. I was in Northern California. They sent me to Northern California, opened an office, then consolidated 10 years later. I came back down to Southern California, worked 3 years, and the company went bankrupt. And I had worked at the same job for 28 years. And I was not a young girl going in for, the job market.
Right.
I had to look for a job in, almost 30 years. So, what do I do? I had a lot of skills.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time that I went and got that job and worked up from the bottom to management level, I didn't need a degree, and I didn't know that. I was on the job training, and I knew every aspect of that particular company. And I knew that I had a resume that was 3 pages long almost, but for the age, being a woman, of color, that makes a difference. And
absolutely.
I had to encounter that within the company for 28 years.
Yes.
I was used for 18 of the 28 before I ever, really progressed. But it was a weird feeling because what do I do now? I've been here, this was my life. and now it's gone.
Absolutely.
And it was very
traumatic.
Hard.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Anybody else?
I thought it was interesting when the company I worked for went basically bankrupt with no notice. I came back from lunch, my boss
in
the parking lot, and said, "Guess what? I have some news for you." And even though my financial situation was such that, in a way, it was like not a big deal. I mean, it could have taken me a year to find another job, and it wouldn't have financially been a problem. It was really weird because I just felt kind of panicky. And like, I was planning a trip to the East Coast to visit my friend. I got to cancel that. I got to look for a job. I've got to be here and all that. And I mean, it only took like 8 weeks, but it was just this kind of feeling of, you sometimes get kind of wrapped up in your employment. And when it's suddenly not there, it's like a part of your identity.
Yes, it is your identity. My experience of working with people in Job Mart said to me that we define ourselves by our employment. We define who we are as people. We define ourselves as successful. We define ourselves emotionally. We define ourselves in every way by our employment. And I came to the conclusion that that was really too bad, that we really needed to find some other ways of defining who we are, because we need that balance. During that time, I was working with people who were chronically unemployed, who had been, by chronically, I mean that they had been employed generally more than 6 months. And in addition to that, they had worked in a job for 28, 30 years plus, and they had been released by the company, and they were going through all kinds of emotional crises about what did this say about them? You know, what, haven't I done a good job? I've been this loyal employee all these years, and all of a sudden, I don't count anymore. And in addition to that, most of the people I worked with in Arizona were quite middle-aged men who were 55 and over. And I'll tell you, that was an interesting experience for me, because my understanding is that generally white men who were at least 55 years and over were persons who had grown up thinking that this would never happen to them. You know, that everything would be made available to them. And all of a sudden, it wasn't there anymore. And it was awful. Well, anyway, I didn't really mean to get into that extensively, but that was a learning experience for me. Anybody else want to comment before I go on? Well, I'd like to share some figures with you, some information, and then we can talk about it. And for the purposes of this discussion, since I came here prepared to relate to Rainbow on the Mountaintop, I wanted to share with you information that's been recently published by the National Urban League that talks about the racial unemployment gap for 1989. And so for the purposes of this discussion, I want to compare figures for you that are those of African American and white persons in the United States. That's not to say that other ethnic groups don't experience many of these same issues, but these are the ones for today that I really want to share with you. At any rate, as we enter into the 1990s, one of the most critical unresolved issues is the persistence of racial inequality in employment. In particular, the wide disparity in the employment rates of African Americans and whites, if trends continue, could have dangerous consequences on this nation's economic viability in the 21st century. We should all be concerned that the official African-American unemployment rate was 2.5, two and a half times that of whites in 1989. This is a larger gap than existed in the beginning of the 1980s, when African-American workers were 2.3 times more likely to be jobless. Therefore, it is safe to say that policies and programs which were developed in the 80s, which were intended to curb the high rate of unemployment, were basically ineffectual. For the most part, the policies which were developed emphasized general economic growth as a means of promoting greater employment opportunity. And in fact, there has been a decline in unemployment since 1983. The trickle-down policy was really effective. However, there was produced during this time a larger unemployment gap between African Americans and white persons in this country. Persons of color and language other than English and women have historically been slower to benefit from economic upswings than whites and tend to benefit less well. The official civilian labor force was 124 million people during the fourth quarter of last year, over 2 million more than the fourth quarter of 1988. In 1989, there were 13.5 million African American people in the workforce. While the number of jobless white workers decreased by 98,000 people, the number of unemployed African American people was about 1.5 million for the last two quarters of 1989. And 22.8% African American females were unemployed. Unemployment was especially high for teenage African American females. 50.1% were jobless. As I read this, I thought about the implications of that for teenage pregnancy or relating to teenage pregnancy issues, and the teenage mothers, young women who have children that they are responsible to support. And just thinking about unemployment and all the other issues that attend that particular situation, it's something that perhaps we may want to talk about later. Statistically, this group has a very low employment to population ratio, with less than one-third of the population employed, or 27.2%. However, African American males are the hardest hit by unemployment, and that rate is 11.5%. So, having all these figures, I'd like for us to spend a little bit of time discussing the social implications that result from these figures. What do you see the impact being as we look toward the 1990s? As I told you, I came with no answers about this, but I have some biases, I guess.
What do you see as the primary reason for that gap?
Well, does anybody else have any ideas about that? About that answer?
Education.
Education
is one. Okay. Now I'll write. Okay.
And that in itself is a big thing, because there's been a cut in government funding to students. The cost of education has gotten higher. It's been more difficult for low income and minority students to get into schools because of a variety of things in terms of of finances. So education's a big can of worms in a lot of ways.
Okay, yes, Bob?
The displacement of jobs to areas where blacks aren't living, unlike the Chicago area, there seem to be more jobs out in the west, northwestern suburbs than there are in the inner city areas. And
okay. Yes.
I think children and youth need role models to encourage them and inspire them to continue their education, to make, you know, make them believe that it can be done. I'm not sure how to say that.
Okay.
And yes. That the breakdown in families these days, where that leads to the lack of good role models for youth, and it's this, well, becomes the thing to do or not to do. You know, you don't see anything, you don't, you're not, there's no inspiration.
Okay.
I think we're becoming more service or industry. I think the industry has changed a lot to from industrial to more service, and the shift, I think, is taking its toll.
It's and interesting.
The whole global thing, the multinationals moving out of this country, going to other countries to get things produced that could be done here.
Yeah, in the report.
The cheaper labor pits people against people, I think.
In that Urban League report, they cited that same thing, showing the figures of African-American people who were being displaced by employment was very high because many had been in those jobs that have been transferred, shall we say, to other countries. And it has really affected the job market availability for persons who are in skilled jobs. Yes.
What about lack of adequate child care to allow the single person to hold down a job?
Okay. I was just going to ask you about the issues of our systems. You know, how do our systems really perpetuate unemployment? That's good.
Racism.
Racism. Mm-hmm.
Does the illegal operations like drugs have an effect in here too?
How do you mean?
Well, I'm just thinking drugs. Is the balance a little bit more on the side of the poor and so forth than the other areas?
I don't have figures about that relating to that.
You have a big war on drugs, and I just.
I think that the whole issue of drugs does play a part, a major part, really. But I believe that it plays a part both sides. It's when you look at unemployment and persons who have no hope in their lives, generally, well, anybody, I was going to say younger persons, but when people have no hope and yet they see that they can stand to really make a lot of money being involved in drugs, then, you know, I think that is one of the options that they go for. I think that when I think about how it impacts unemployment, I don't know. What do you think, Joan?
Because it becomes an option for, I mean, when you talk about unemployment rate and the terrible, the worst disparity is at young male.
Absolutely.
Young African-American young male. And if other options are not open, then the drug scene seems to be the way to make money.
Absolutely. Yeah. Anybody else? One of the things that I started looking at was legislation, obviously, since that's what I do. And the legislation that we need to be looking at as it relates to issues of unemployment. And one of those, well, let me talk about some that's been enacted that I think is really inadequate, that perpetuates a lot of the problem. One of the major pieces that was passed last year was the Family Support Act, under the guise of welfare reform. And that piece of legislation was meant to move people from being on the welfare rolls, has as part of one of its programs what's called JOBS, or a program that is supposed to place people in training programs and employment education programs related to skills training that would mean that they could move from the welfare rolls to employment rolls. The problem is that legislation only targets a certain population of people, generally targets people who are single women, a single family, what is it, single female heads of households, which is great. But that person needs to be able to ensure that she has child care available to her. There is a portion of the bill that provides for child care, but it is totally inadequate. And so if that young woman and does not have access to child care readily available to her, or she happens to be one of those persons who's lucky enough to qualify under this narrowly defined program, she isn't eligible and isn't able then to access the program. So you end up then with a number of single female heads of households who are not able to access that program and have difficulty qualifying for welfare assistance, or it's not really welfare, it's called aid to families with dependent children, but the whole program has been somewhat redefined, and not everyone has access to it. My concern about that program is that as I looked at the legislation, there was a House proposal and a Senate proposal. The reason we went along with the Senate proposal in this country is because the amount of money that it took to enact that legislation was lower than the amount that the House bill required. However, the House bill was going to provide that a person or a family would be eligible for case management, a kind of a case management approach to their particular situation, so that you could track that person through a number of steps, enabling them to move to self-sufficiency, which is what I think we're supposed to be about. So, and the Senate bill, which is what we enacted, doesn't do that. So we can put people into this jobs program and hope that they will get training that will enable them to have some skills to go to work. But we have no guarantee of that. We have no guarantee of what will happen with them at the end of their training. And we don't really have an adequate child care program in place to ensure that the children are cared for even if they do get the training. So we continue in our, started to say short-sightedness. We continue to perpetuate the problem that we really want to alleviate, I believe, by not really having enough systems in place to care for the problem. That's one piece. There's a Civil Rights Act of 1990 that's on the books right now that that is in conference committee, and we're hopeful that it will be passed. And one of the big hang-ups in that piece of legislation is that it provides that a person who's claiming discrimination can charge punitive damages, can claim punitive damages if the employer is found to be discriminatory in its practice, in their hiring practices. Well, as you can well imagine, there are a number of employers who don't want to see that portion of the legislation become a part of the entire bill. So at any rate, there are a number of legislative issues that continue to impact issues of employment that we need to be concerned about. Yes?
That particular program that you're speaking of, I know of a young woman who went through it, and she went to school during the hours that her children were in school. Mm-hmm. But I think that the professional counselors that they have are inadequate because they don't follow up to see that they even use the skills that we then have paid for them to acquire.
Exactly.
Because she did nothing with it.
Yeah.
Did absolutely nothing with that skills that she acquired. And they don't get any counseling once they are completed it or follow through to see that they use the skills that they have acquired. So it's just a waste of money and waste of time.
I agree. That's the thing that was really so disheartening about seeing that particular legislation passed, because there was no tracking mechanism. You know, there was no way to really ensure that the right thing was going to happen. So what we continue to do, I believe, that's unfortunate, is we continue to perpetuate that system that keeps people dependent. And I wish I could be a voice of more hope. That I find it very disturbing, because I don't like to see the welfare system perpetuated either for persons who are able to, who could be able to move on in their lives and take care of themselves, just as they don't really want that for themselves. I mean, nobody would choose to be poor. But I think it's really sad what we're doing. And the only way that I know that we're going to have, that we do have some options to really change the system, I believe, by really responding at the state and the national level to these issues. Were you going to say something? Did I? Okay. Yeah, I hear you. One of the ways that I think we have an opportunity to respond really right now is to the proposed Graham Rudman tax program that there is going to be voted on very shortly as a part of the budget reconciliation package. If Graham Rudman goes into effect, let's see, what do I show here? The spending, the domestic discretionary programs are going to be tremendously cut. And that means they'll be cut by nearly one-fifth or 19%. And the thing that just is really frightening to me is that these domestic programs include things as education that we were talking about earlier, Head Start, education for the homeless, financial aid for needy students, commodity supplemental food program, the WIC program, women, infants, and children's feeding program, money for emergency food and shelter, and so forth. Down the line, there's a whole list here of all the programs that would be cut if Graham Rudman goes into effect. I would say that what we can all do is write a letter to our representatives in Congress telling them of our concern about that proposal and our concern about how it will affect people who are poor and powerless. That's one of the things we can do. Does anybody else smell something?
Yes, I went to check.
Yeah. Oh.
And it's back with at the kiln.
Oh, thank you. I've really been sensitized to fire here.
Yeah, the burning some sawdust, we think, to dry it out.
Thank you for checking. Great. So what do you all think about this in the next few minutes we have?
I'm at 19% cut you're speaking of. Is that all governmental programs, is it cut 19%, or is it just the social welfare programs?
It would be social welfare, the domestic discretionary programs. Not all programs would be cut. There are some programs that are considered to be discretionary, like those where we provide assistance to homeless persons by providing shelters and food for persons who are homeless. We've been working to try to get the WIC program developed as an entitlement program. But, you know, there is still a portion of that that could be cut by this. It's really frightening. I happen to bring that with me because I just think that while we have high levels of unemployment, that to me says we have people who have great needs. And to just cut out the safety net from underneath them, well, that's gone anyway, but to really totally wipe out, not totally, partially cut the systems of support that are available to persons, I think is really a crime.
Yes. What do you see in terms of young people, for example, or people being educated to be employed for? For example, steel's gone. Mm-hmm. Rural is out, going out.
It's interesting. I've read a couple of studies in some magazines where they talk about what are some of the jobs of the 90s. And most of those jobs really do require that you have some skills of some sort. You know, you have to go into them really knowing how to do something, even if it's type. And what do we do about those persons who have no skills at this point? Or where they have skills that have been... They no longer exist because for one reason or another they've been eliminated from our society basically as viable means of employment.
Well, a number of those things that you identified as being cuts in Graham Rudman have to do with education. And I really think that's in terms of employment, that really is a basic. If you cut the opportunities for education, then you cut the opportunities for employment. I mean, you're just wiping them out right at the baseline. And if that's not addressed, then unemployment will continue to rise, as will crime, and as will more dissension and more anger, and it will increase the divide among peoples and add to the racism and misunderstanding that already exists. Mm-hmm.
I was just going down a whole different track. It seems to me that all of us in this room have to learn to be more acquainted with and willing to talk to our congresspeople on the federal budget.
Absolutely.
And there's so many things about it that just seem puzzling to us, and that they're talking about amounts of money that, that we can't understand. But our money is going for things we would not want it to go to, and it's not going where we would like to have it go. But the only way we can do anything about that is become more aware. So that that federal budget primer from Network, I would send to Sarah and get that.
Yes, there is a program in Washington that a number of organizations are a part of. It's a coalition of sorts that is entitled the Citizens Budget Campaign. And that Citizens Budget Campaign is made up of a number of different denominations, faith groups, and secular organizations that have come together to address the issue of the national budget, their concern about the national budget, the fact that dollars are being cut where we don't want them cut. And so they've developed a whole program of response to the budget summit committee persons, as well as the Senate Finance Committee and the House Ways and Means Committee. And I would invite you to respond. And one of the ways that you could do that would be to be in touch with our office, indicating that you are interested in being a part of that campaign. Or by, let's see, I don't happen to have Network's address with me.
But contacting your office, you could learn about Network.
Right, right. They're the group that is overseeing that whole campaign. It's called Network, and it's a Catholic social justice lobby.
And they have an 8-page primer to help you understand what the budget is. Not nearly as confusing as we're
led to believe. Yes.
There are some principles in there that we could all understand if we could get hold of them.
Absolutely.
Sarah, will you be able to come up with Network's address, or can we just write to your office?
Just write to our office.
Okay.
Yeah. Didn't someone over? Yes.
My comment was along the lines of, there's nothing wrong with Graham Rudman, in a sense. We have a budget process which is being played with, you might say, I think, and Graham Rudman is a good threat. I'd like to see it stay there, and if we have to raise taxes to cover these things, or if the government can't afford all these programs, maybe it's time to bite that bullet or something. But where we can't be deficit spending as totally as we have been all these years.
I agree. The problem is that what happens with that is that systems are put in place to ensure that the rich get richer and the poor get poor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the problem.
Which ones are richer?
Good question. It's not me. But but I am richer than the poor, than people who are poor. I am. And I really have to admit that. You know, I have to look at boy, I live, and then take some responsibility for my commitment by responding to the issue.
But it's the rich getting richer. We're talking about people with annual incomes of $200,000 and more.
Exactly.
Who are benefiting from this, and it's the middle class are getting hit.
Yeah.
Very hard.
There exactly.
Are farmers that make more than $200,000. Are they rich?
Yes.
$200,000 is not, hey. Wouldn't mind that.
Double what a congressman gets?
No. I don't know what congressperson's salaries are, but they generally are not.
No, they're not
high. particularly based on all the things that they're involved in. And anyway, no. I would say that the hope for this situation lies with us. That it is important that we understand that we have responsibility. And we have some power to do that. My bias is that each of us carries one vote, and that is power. And that it is important for you and me to respond to our congresspersons. And every time we make a phone call or write a letter in regard to legislation, that has an impact. I won't go into how to advocate today, but it really is important to do that. It's really important to address the issues. And so, you know, I believe that in this country, we've been duped into thinking that we have no power, and most of us feel very helpless to affect any changes. Because the big business interests ensure that they are able to provide the money to continue to buy the votes, to continue to make the difference. But I would suggest to you that you aren't being bought. And generally, most of us who are citizens are not being bought. And because of that, we need to understand that we have the opportunity to influence the vote. Every time we write a letter, that congressperson multiplies that times whatever the formula it is they've developed in their office that says that that one response represents 200 or 100 or whatever it is that they've developed for their particular geographical area in the country. So one letter does make a difference. And so I would suggest that if you have a concern about the way we are developing budget policy, particularly in this case, that you would respond, that you would write a letter. And that's the hope. The hope lies with us. Are there any other comments? Well, thank you very much for coming. Tomorrow we'll be talking about healthcare. So I hope you'll come back and join me. Thank you. Thank you.